Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Borders Conference. Thank you all very much for coming. As you can see, we're a small group, very informal. Please get up, wander around, have coffee, whatever you need to do. So we've got three papers today, so we're going to have each paper and then a discussion afterwards. So each slot is about half an hour, and then we'll have a break for lunch. And then if anyone wants to stay and talk about grant bids, whether you'd like to join one or talk about one you've got in process or get any advice about grant bids to do with the Borders Network, then I'd be very happy to talk to you. So our first speaker today is Ad Putter, Professor of Medieval Literature in the Department of English at the University of Bristol. Ad, as many of you will know, has just got a large Leverhulme grant, and he's going to talk to us partly about the material for the grant. So his topic today is William Caxton, Kentish English or Dutch Language Without Borders. Thanks, Ad.
Thank you very much. Very nice to have a chance to introduce the project very briefly. But I'm not going to give an overview of the project. I really would like to get to grips with something which I think centrally concerns the question of borders. So I want to deliver on the remit of the organiser, Helen. Thank you very much, Helen, for putting this together. So our project is called The Literary Heritage of Anglo-Dutch Relations. We are deliberately going across chronological borders. We're going to do both medieval and take the 16th century into account as well. The starting point for the project is that we don't think there ever was a glorious revolution in 1688. You may know that in 1688, a Dutch king came to the English throne, William, the Stadtholder of Holland. And a lot of work has been done by historians of that period, of the golden age of Dutch history of the 17th century, and a lot has been written on the relations between the Dutch and English speakers from that period. Our premise is that this glorious revolution was in fact a glorious evolution. All these things, starting points, are really rather arbitrary, and no doubt you can take these relations back further, but we start with conquest. And just to emphasize what is called the Norman Conquest was in fact a process of colonization and migration that involved large numbers of Dutch speakers. William the First, that king of England, William's wife was Flemish, and in William's retinue there were large numbers of Flemish speakers. So we have at the beginning of the period, which I'm not a specialist on, but my collaborator, Lisbeth von Hartz, from the University of Cambridge, is a specialist in that area. We have a lot of Flemish migrants who are producing saints' lives in Latin. Occasionally, they scribble things in Dutch. So the earliest fragments of Dutch secular verse are found in an English manuscript copied in Rochester by a Flemish writer. My topic today goes to the going into the Renaissance, really. Well, actually, I'm in the 15th century. It's kind of a very interesting transitional period with the big changes of technology, the introduction of print. And I think printing, that particular period, the period of the incunables and early printing, does relate very directly to the question of borders. And when I introduced the topic, one of the reasons why I thought about Caxton is actually this book by Anne Calderon, University of St. Andrews, who quite recently produced a book called Printers Without Borders, in which she usefully emphasizes the kind of multicultural background of these printers. And one of these printers that she discusses is, of course, the man who introduced printing into England, William Caxton. The sort of schoolboy's version of Caxton is that he's the first English printer. But life is more complicated. And Professor Calderon touches on some of these complications, though not all of them. The first book printed in English was not printed in England. William Paxton Englished the Recueil of the Histories of Troy from the French, and he printed it in Bruges in 1473. That's probably wrong. He probably printed it in Ghent, but never mind. What did it mean to English a book? The verb to English simply meant to translate into English, but the actual practice of Englishing involved much more than verbal translation. The Recueil, like so many other early printed English books, came from a French language, mediated medieval work, and was produced by a bilingual printer-translator using continental technology, typefaces, and book design. Not only the literary text, but also the materials and methods of production were foreign and underwent processes of acculturation. In this, the Recueil is no anomaly, no quirky experimental exile. Its Francophone, Burgundian origins instead signal crucial characteristics of early modern English literary culture. It constitutes a foreignness established in translation, transformed by new technology and perpetuated in reprints. This is an attempt, I think, quite useful to get away from an anachronistic, nationalistic version of Caxton as defined English printer. But in doing so, it actually simplifies things absurdly, as in this example. English-born Paxton too was a polyglot cultural amphibian who worked in the Low Countries and Francophone Bruges during some formative years. The majority of his production was translated from French. I am not happy with this. Have you ever been to Bruges? If you have, you will realize it is not predominantly Francophone. That wasn't in this period. It was largely Dutch-speaking. And the notion of Paxton being, as it were, Burgundian-influenced, not entirely false, but it does simplify the facts. He spent 30 years all in all in the Low Countries. And one of the things I think is very clear from his work that he must have been not just bilingual, he had competence in French, but trilingual. He clearly had Dutch, and himself translated various works from Dutch. History of Reinhard Fox, in 1481 he printed this, based on Reinhard's history, which he must have got his hold on, his hands on really fast. He must have still had his networks, as it were, in the Low Countries. And then this Dialogues in French and English, which is actually based on a Dutch-French conversation manual from Bruges, around about 1340. You will probably realise why I'm interested in Caxton and why he interests me from this Anglo-Dutch perspective. And what Caxton himself has to say about his languages is the following. This is from his prologue to his first printed book, where he apologises for the simpleness and unperfectness that I had in both languages. That is to wit, in French and in English. For in France was I never, and was born I learned my English in Kent in the Weald. I think that's how you pronounce it, isn't it? The Weald in Kent, particular area in Kent, I'll come back to that. Where I doubt not is spoken as broad and rude English as in any place of England. And I've continued by the space of 30 years for the most part in the countries of Brabant, Flanders, Holland, and Zeeland. So we have an Englishman here who's apologising for the state of his two languages, English and French. And the reason why he's apologising is, well, it's because I've spent 30 years living in the Low Countries. Although he doesn't mention Dutch, he thinks actually that the reason for that one of the reasons why his French and English isn't up to scratch, is that he's spending all this time in the Low Countries surrounded by another language, Dutch. In fact, it's been suggested, unpersuasively, I think, that Caxton's mother tongue may have been Flemish. Basis for this is a little anecdote which I think has been misunderstood by Richard Deacon. Again, it's a little anecdote that sheds a lot of light on languages in this period. In my days, it happened that certain merchants were in a ship in the Thames for to have sailed over the sea into Zealand. And for lack of wind, they tarried at Foreland. Foreland is an area in Kent, not far from Ramsgate, I think, in Kent, and went to land for to refresh them. And one of them, named Sheffield, a mercer, came into a house and asked for meat, and specially he asked after eggs. And the good wife answered that she could speak no French. And the merchant was angry, for he could also speak no French, but would have had eggs, and she understood him not. And then at last another said that he would have iron. Then the good wife said that she understood him well. Lord, what should a man in these days of now write, eggs or iron? That's from his preface to Eneidos. Now, it so happens that iron is also the Flemish word for eggs. But and Richard Deacon concludes from this that the Caxton here is thinking in Flemish. But iron is also simply the word in the Southern dialect for eggs. What this does usefully reveal, I think, is that differences between dialects can be as great as differences between what we would think of as foreign languages. And this may have been especially true for a man like Caxton from this area in Kent, which has very interesting dialect characteristics. And I'd like to say something about these dialect characteristics, because I think it explains why Caxton found Dutch quite easy, and also why I find traces of what linguists call interference between Dutch and English in his works. So here comes something tedious about dialect now. Features of the Kentish dialect. Here are a few examples, things that happen in this dialect. In this dialect, F is pronounced as V. So then instead of saying the fox and the wolf, if you're in Kent, you say the vox and the wolf. It's also, by the way, what you do in Dutch. Because, indeed, right, two single F becomes V. F is V. It's a feature shared in this dialect in Kent, and it's also a fact of Dutch. Old English K has become J in modern English, but not in this dialect, it remains. So in Kent, you would say Zeggen instead of Sayen, instead of Say. But that is also true for Dutch, where you say Zeggen. The present participle is in, I am going to the market, and so on. But in this dialect, it was NDE. Again, it's true in Dutch too. In this dialect, long E from Old English ale isn't spelt E or pronounced A, it was pronounced E. So deep comes in Kentish dialect as deep, as in Dutch. In this dialect, the final ETH from the third person becomes a final T, as in Dutch. So there are various ways in which this Kentish dialect corresponds to Dutch. And the reasons for this, I think, are historic, that this part of Kent was actually settled by Jutes. So you've got a longer history going back of Anglo-Dutch relations, which actually explains similarities in dialect. I think these dialect similarities do shed some light on some features that we find in Caxton's works. And I think we need to move away from the notion that Caxton was... I mean, people, of course, know that Caxton wasn't monolingual, but still, when you think about translation practice, it's very easy to slip back into a monolingual model. And that's what we end up with. If we think of Caxton as, he's usually said, as a hasty translator, who when he translates from Dutch, can't be bothered to think what the English equivalent might be, but imports words from Dutch into English. As in this example, very early on in the history of Reinhard, which he translates from Dutch, if the fox will tell you how it befell, I will give him the foredale thereof. For I cannot tell it so well, but he shall berisp me. Is this English? Well, berisp is taken over straight from the source. It means it's from Dutch, berispen. You might say he doesn't bother to translate it, he just takes over the word. That's how the whole idea of Caxton as a lazy translator has arisen, examples of this. But when you look at it more closely, it becomes more interesting. This word, foredale, it's from Dutch. But you find it in other English works already. From the York Mystery Plays, it's found in the Parson Letters in Norfolk. And the interesting thing is it's not in the source. He's translating a different... The word in the source is voorwaarde. So he's not lifting a word from the Dutch source and importing it. It's a word he knows. It's part of his vocabulary. It's certainly a borrowing because he uses it in a sense that isn't otherwise attested in English. It means privilege. That sense is only attested in Dutch. But we can't be dealing with a hasty translator who plucks words from his original because the word isn't in the original. Then there's a curious thing that we find him using these same words in other works where he's not translating. This is Mallory's Mordatha. Caxton edited some of this, the Roman War episode. And you can tell this is Caxton's voice. Thus the battle was great. And oftsides that one party was at the foredale, and another at an afterdeal. He's not translating from Dutch. There's no question of being a lazy translator. What you've got here is a person who's thinking, who's part thinking in Dutch, and who's got a vocabulary that simply has lots of Dutch words in it as a result. Another example, between, it's used in the Reinhard, and you might think, he's lazily adopted the word and he hasn't bothered to translate it. But the bizarre thing is that he uses it in other works when he's not translated from the Dutch. It means to constrain the Twingen. This is a translation from the French. So often when he's translated, you might think it's a translation from Latin, but it isn't. Caxton used French mediations whenever he was translating from Latin. So when he's translating from French, he's importing quite a lot of Dutch words. And here are other examples of words that we find from Dutch. I won't say anything much about that because I have to move on. How do we explain this phenomenon? We must move away from the idea of a translator. We must be looking at studies of bilingualism or multilingualism, and we must be looking at how interference works. linguistic interference. This is where the closeness between Dutch and Flemish, Dutch and Kentish, become, I think, especially interesting, because it is in fact well demonstrated in empirical studies that the closer the languages are, the greater, of course, the likelihood of linguistic interference is. And we must also get away from the idea that he's just taping over words. Linguistic interference is not just a matter of vocabulary. Linguistic interference is all pervasive. It's going to affect pronunciation. It's going to affect grammar. It's going to affect spelling. As in these examples, the normal way of spelling here for Paxton is with single E or double E. But when he's translating from the Reinhardt, and occasionally in works that he prints in the Low Countries, we suddenly find these Dutch or Kentish spellings with IE. The word, the word means trapdoor, valdeur. He's taken it over from Dutch. But to me, just as interesting is the fact that he'll occasionally spell it with a V, not with an F. The long O, which you would normally spell as O or O-O, appears in the spelling O-E occasionally. Then we've got phonological interference. The golden fleece, you can imagine that word comes up quite a lot in the history of Jason. Twice, you get this spelling, Fliese. That's the Dutch spelling. Stepmother. Spelled in the Rukai once. Like that. Stiefmoeder. And that's because it's the influence of the Dutch version of that word. And so on. So what we've got is a kind of imprint, Dutch imprint, if you like, on his language. And it's there in grammar. Always the past participle is in. But in his first work, probably printed in Ghent, you find two of these participles. They've always been thought of as Kentish archaisms in his language, but are they Kentish or are they Flemish, where you would have exactly the same past participle ending? It's actually very difficult to say. So, here's an interesting conclusion. Paxton was at different times, to different degrees, Kentish, English, French, and Dutch. These identities were not necessarily in conflict, but could be mutually reinforcing. I'm very interested in the fact that it's in these synergies, if you like, between his Kentish dialect and the Flemish dialect. And sometimes it's the sheer difficulty of knowing what language or what dialect is actually influencing him. I'll stop there.